This is the Fairyland Murders podcast, True Crime in Edwardian London. This episode is about Donald Lesbini and Alice Story. The date is Wednesday, the 12th of August, 1914. It's sunny and warm, and just a few days earlier, on the 4th, Great Britain had declared war on Germany. Donald Lesbini was 22. He'd originally come from Handsworth in Birmingham, but on the 12th of August, he was in London and miserable. He'd not had a happy life. He'd been in trouble with the law twice as a child, and he'd joined the army in September 1911 when he was 17 years old. His army records report his conduct was good. However, he was being joked at by other soldiers for his foreign looks and foreign-sounding name. They thought he was Jewish. And being short at 1 meter 50 and thin at 50 kilograms, he was probably bullied. He was working as a tailor in the 3rd Battalion, the Worcestershire Regiment, which was based at Salisbury Plain. He'd been estranged from his father, and he hadn't been back to Birmingham since he joined the army. On this day in August 1914, he was a deserter for the second time. Donald Lesbini was living at the Monmouth Hotel in Drummond Street, just north of Euston Road, paying week by week in advance. And on this day, he visited Fairyland. He'd been there 3 or 4 times before, and each time he'd gone, he'd been taunted by the attendant Alice Story. She'd said that he was Jewish and that he was mean and skinny because he wouldn't buy things for her. On his visit on the 12th of August, he had no money whatsoever. He went there to practice shooting at the shooting range. And he said his express purpose in asking for shots was for the reason that he contemplated taking his own life, because he was so miserable through being despised and looked down upon no matter where he went. That, he said, was what made him desert the army and was the thing that drove him to despair more than once. Alice Story was an assistant at Fairyland. She was single, 27 years old, and originally from Essex. Her parents had been travellers, and she had 3 brothers and 3 sisters. At Fairyland, her duties were to attend to the shooting range, and that included the loading and unloading of the rifles and the revolvers. Anyone applying to use a rifle or revolver would be allowed to do so if she considered them capable and sober. And Alice herself, according to her sister Minnie, was cheerful, healthy and sober. The time was 3 minutes to 4 on the 12th of August. Henry Stanton Morley, the owner of Fairyland, wasn't there that day, but his wife Lily was. She was seated behind the hoopla counter and at that time was talking to Alice Story. There were other people working in Fairyland at that time. Annie Nuttall was looking after the Japanese rollaway game. There was Dixon Lyle doing some cleaning, and there was also Betsy Levy. According to Annie Nuttall, Donald Lesbini came in and walked up to the shooting range. Annie went over and spoke to Alice. Alice came from the hoopla stall to the range and tapped Lesbini on the shoulder as he faced the range. And, well, she said a word that can describe somebody as being Jewish in a derogatory way. I'm not going to say that word. I'm just going to say the word cat instead. She said, "Cat wants some shots." Lesbini replied, "Don't you talk to me like that." And Alice Story said, "It's the way I talk to my customers. I'm only joking." And Lesbini said, "Don't let it happen again." Lesbini looked at Annie Nuttall and smiled. And Alice Story said, "There, he has soon got rid of his temper." It then quietened down. Alice asked Donald Lesbini if he wanted any shooting and if he wanted a rifle or a revolver. And he said a revolver and pointed at one in the case. Alice was unlocking the case and dropped the keys, and Lesbini picked them up. And Alice said to Annie, There, he picked up the keys for me. It just shows what a temper he had. Alice then unlocked the case and loaded the revolver and gave the revolver to him. And Donald was standing close to the counter, facing the range. He held up the revolver towards the target where he was supposed to shoot. But he then brought it down towards his side, then passed it in front of Annie Nuttall's face, addressing Alice Storey. He said, "Now I've got you." He pointed the revolver to her and she ran to the corner. Alice struggled to get over the counter, but didn't. She'd gone a few yards. Annie ran out of the shop. Just as she got as far as the hoopla stand, she heard Alice scream, "Oh, don't!" And then she heard a shot, followed by a terrible scream. Behind the hoopla stand counter was Lily Morley. She said the shot sounded different to the ordinary firing at the range. And immediately before the shot, Lily also heard, "Oh, don't, don't." Lily looked up and saw Les Beeny with a revolver in his right hand, pointed towards the hoopla stand and partly towards Lily. Lily ran. She ran upstairs. Betsy Levy was at the billiards table and she was serving a customer. She heard screaming. She turned around and she saw Les Beeny by the rollaway table. And Alice Storey was also standing near the table in front of the man at a distance of about 2 or 3 yards. Betsy heard a report and saw Alice running past her. She then saw the man standing in front of the range with a revolver in his right hand. Alice Storey was screaming as she passed Betsy. Alice turned by the hoopla stand and fell on the stairs. Dixon Lyle was cleaning some glass about 6 yards from the shooting range. He was on a pair of steps. He heard the scream immediately followed by the report of a revolver. He jumped down from the steps after looking around and saw Les Beeny standing with his back to the range. He saw Les Beeny with the revolver in his hand, pointing it towards the hoopla stand, about level with his shoulder. Lyle ran at him and seized the barrel of the revolver and caught him by the throat. Les Beeny said, "Don't choke me." Lyle took the revolver from him and held him until the police came. Dixon Lyle said, "Les Beeny said nothing else to me. I heard no conversation between him and the attendant before I heard the scream." After 2 or 3 minutes, Annie Nuttall returned. And she found Alice Storey lying on the staircase leading up to the first floor. She was unconscious. PC John Kisby was on duty in Tottenham Court Road near Mortimer Markets on the opposite side of the road. He went across the road and to 92 Tottenham Court Road and he saw Alice Storey lying on the stairs in a pool of blood and screaming. He saw Dixon Lyle holding a man against the shooting range in the shop. Lyle said, "He shot that woman," and at the same time, Lyle handed him the revolver. PC Kisby took Les Beeny into custody, and Les Beeny said, "She insulted me, and I shot her." He took Les Beeny to Tottenham Court Road police station, where he was detained. PC Albert Sims went to Ferryland at 4 p.m. and saw Alice Storey sitting on the footway outside and supported by attendants. He got her into a taxi cab and drove her to University College Hospital. She was unconscious and she died on the way. Detective Sergeant Bradley reported that Les Beeny, after arrest, said, "They were worrying me. They are always doing it when I go there. I warned her what I would do. But she would not leave me alone. She kept on and I shot her. They call me a Jew, but I'm not." Les Beeny's trial was in September 1914. It was before Mr. Justice Atkins at the Central Criminal Court. At the trial, Les Beeny said, "I went to the shooting range at 92 Tottenham Court Road and asked for a revolver to fire 6 shots. The person who I asked told the deceased what I required. She then started making fun of me on account of my name and nationality, a thing which I had cautioned her about two or three times before, which put me each time in a state of great provocation. This thing happened on this occasion. The deceased loaded the revolver and placed it down for me to use while still tantalizing me. I then took the revolver and placed it at full cock, ready for firing. I then took aim at the target. I have already said I was in a state of great provocation, and I turned around to the deceased and said, "Look here, I've had enough of this." I was going to say, "I shall see the manager," but before I could say those words, she ran away screaming. I followed her to finish what I was going to say, not knowing exactly what I was going to do with the revolver, which was at full cock, and only needed the slightest touch to explode the charge. It went off, and with no intention whatsoever on my part. That is how the thing occurred. I can only say I am extremely sorry that such a thing has occurred by my hand. But I had no intention of doing it whatsoever. That is all I have to say. The defence entered a plea of insanity, and evidence was called to show that the accused was lacking in mental balance. Whilst in custody at Brixton Prison, he was examined by Sidney Reginald Dyer, senior medical officer, and he reported that while here, he has been quiet, well conducted, and perfectly rational, both in conduct and conversation. He appears from his history to be a hot-tempered, sensitive lad with defective control and want of mental balance, but I have never discovered any indication of insanity about him. He concluded his report, "With regard to this case, I have come to the following conclusions. Namely, 1. That while on remand, he has been sane. 2. That at the time of his offence, there is nothing to show from the evidence, nor from my observation here, that he did not know the nature and quality of his acts, and that they were wrong. 3. That he is fit to plead." So he was judged sane, but was he provoked? The judge set the jury a dual test for provocation. 1. That the provocation might cause a reasonable man to lose self-control, and 2. That it actually caused the accused to do so. And this new standard of provocation contained both a subjective and an objective component. In essence, the gravity of the provocation must be sufficient. And this test has been established now in British, Canadian, and Australian law that with regard to voluntary manslaughter, a reasonable man always has reasonable powers of self-control. The verdict to the jury was Lesbini was found guilty of murder. It was held that a reasonable man would not have responded so strongly to comparatively little provocation. The jury found him guilty but strongly recommended him to mercy. However, the judge sentenced him to death. We have some letters after the trial. This one from the governor of Pentonville Prison. "Dear Sir, Donald Lesbini, in reply to yours of the 12th instant, I beg to inform you that the High Sheriff of the County of London has, subject to appeal, fixed Tuesday the 29th of September at 9 a.m. for the execution of this prisoner in Pentonville Prison. I propose to employ Ellis as executioner and have no objection to your having an assistant as usual if you so desire. I shall be glad in due course, assuming the convict is not respited, if you would give me particulars of his weight and height. Yours faithfully." Lesbini did appeal on the 15th of September, but he was refused leave to appeal. The prison sent a letter to Donald Lesbini's mother on the 6th of October, to Mrs. Maud Lesbini, 2 Birchfield Road, Birmingham. Number 6257, D. Lesbini has permission to dispose of his private clothing and wishes it be sent to you, his authority for which will be found below. The articles are enumerated on the other side. Please state on the back hereof, at number 3, whether you are willing to receive them and pay the carriage if they are sent to you, or whether you will call for them. If no reply is received within 21 days from this date, the clothing will be sold. List of clothing. Straw hat, 1. Jacket, 1. Trousers, 1. Shirts, 1. Boots, 1. Socks, 1. Handkerchiefs, 1. Drawers, none. Braces, 1. Fronts, 1. Collars, 1. Waistcoat, 1. Undershirts, 1. 28th of September. Dear Sir, Donald Lisbini, I thank you for your letter of the 26th inst and beg to inform you that the High Sheriff has fixed Tuesday, October the 13th at 9 a.m. for the execution of this convict at Pentonville Prison. Kindly let me have particulars of weight and height in due course. Yours faithfully. On the 2nd of October, Donald Lesbini's death penalty was commuted to penal servitude for life. 2nd of October, Sir, I am directed by the Secretary of State to acquaint you that he has under his consideration the case of Donald Lesbini, now in the prison at Pentonville, under sentence of death, and that he has advised His Majesty to respite the capital sentence with a view to its commutation to penal servitude for life. I am, Sir, your obedient servant. And so he spent the next 20 years in jail. He was released in 1934, and he lived to the age of 63, dying in 1955. You might be able to tell from the aircraft and the fountains and the seagulls that I'm outside. I'm at the National Archives in Kew in West London. This is the place where the Doomsday Book from 1089, I think, Magna Carta 1215, I think, are kept. I've got a lot so far from looking online. Some of the National Archives are digitised, but there may be information that's available in written format that I can't find anywhere else. So I've requested access to 7 different documents from the court cases. Is there any more information I can find? I don't know if I'll be able to record inside. Let's see if I can. So here's the prison records for Donald Lesbini. And there's his photo. 2 photos. One from reception at prison, 31st of October 1914, and one when he was discharged to Broadmoor, which is the 6th of March 1931. So he has an oval face, he has brown eyes, he has dark brown hair, he has a fresh complexion. He looks Southern European. So that's what he looks like. Wow. Scar on lip. He looks miserable. Looks like a sad person. Alice Storey was buried on the 18th of August 1914 at St Pancras Cemetery in Camden. In the next episode, we'll look at the final years of Fairyland. You can contact us by email, fairylandmurders@gmail.com, and we're on Twitter @TheFairylandPod. Thank you for listening. Copyright Ellis Pratt.